The room is small, yet big enough to hold my world. The floorboards are of polished pine, the walls cinder grey, of so delicate a shade it's almost white. The room is not important, and when I close my eyes, it isn't even there. Do not be frightened in your room, they say to me. Eavesdrop on the past, try not to run away from it. Obligingly, I do what I'm told. Middle-aged, a battered look, but my memory is excellent. And I'm perfectly aware that I'm talking to myself. Americans give arms away. Russians promise tanks. In Brussels, an English politician breakfasts with his mistress. A pornographer pretends he's selling Christmas cards. Carefully, I listen. As in childhood, I listened to the hushed conversations of my parents. I stand in the cathedral at Vézelay, whose bishops claimed it possessed the mortal remains of Mary Magdalene. A falseness which was exposed by Pope Boniface VIII. I wonder about that Pope. And then the scene is different. I sit in the Piazza San Marco on the day when I discovered a sea of corruption among the local communists. The music plays. Visitors remark about the pigeons.
Fonografo, per favore.
In the Piazza San Marco, the oblique-faced waiter clears away the coffee cups, which were there when I sat down.
Dubito, signore.
The oblique-faced waiter hurries. Scenes coalesce. Miss McNamara passes along the promenade. Major Trubstall lies. The blue dress flutters and is still. In Rotterdam,
Amy,
I have a nameless
Amy
woman.
Amy Zeldekaart, for your lekker.
In Cornelia, the wine is purple. The path by the coast is marked as a lover's lane. Beatrice and Dante inscribed above a seat with a view. Abelard and Eloise. I am silly, Dorothea says. The dress is just a dress. She laughs, like water running over pebbles. I must try, they tell me. It helps me to go on remembering. I do not argue. I do precisely as they say. Carefully, I remember. Carefully, I write it down. It was Bath. Not Cornelia, not Rotterdam, not Venice, nor Vézelay. It was Bath, where Dorothea and I met by chance in the pump room. Oh, I'm sorry, I said, actually bumping into her. She shook her head, saying that of course I hadn't hurt her. She blamed the crowds, tourists pushing like mad things.
But of course nothing can keep me away. I adore the pump room. I imagine Jane Austen here, you know.
Ah, I've never been here before.
Goodness, you poor thing. But you do like Jane Austen.
Oh, yes, indeed. I was on my way to have some coffee. Would you like some?
I always have coffee when I come.
Quite abruptly, she told me she was studying the history of art, but when she finished that, she didn't know what on earth she was going to do next. She was small, with very fair hair, quite straight and cut quite short. Her oval face was perfect. Her eyes intense, the blue of a washed-out sky.
You're a stranger in Bath.
I came here for a funeral.
Oh.
It's over. My wife's mother came to live here 6 months ago. She died before the weekend.
So you are sadly here?
Hmm? Is that grammatical? Is that what people say?
Oh, yes, if people want to.
Yes, that's important, isn't it? So you were fond of your mother-in-law?
It was taken amiss when I came to her funeral. Charlotte, my wife, well, ex-wife as it happens, thought it peculiar. She was fairly angry.
How horrid.
Oh, no, not at all. I suppose I got on with Charlotte's mother better than she ever did herself. My presence, perhaps, made that point. I may well have been insensitive to come.
You do not have an insensitive face.
Charlotte would disagree. By the look of her this morning, most violently.
Has your wife married again?
To a man who runs a wine business. He was there this morning also.
It must be horrible, a divorce.
Well, it isn't pleasant.
I can never think of my parents divorcing.
Well, it's nice that you can't.
Did you have children?
No.
There's that, at least. But isn't it odd to make such a rudimentary mistake, to marry the wrong person?
Extraordinary.
I don't know what it was about Dorothea's manner that morning, but something seemed to tell me that this beautiful young creature would not be outraged if I said, which I did, that we might go somewhere else in search of a better cup of coffee. And after that, I said, with confidence, let's have a drink.
I'll have to telephone to explain.
Oh, it doesn't matter. I don't mean to delay you.
But I would like to have a drink.
We had lunch together in the Francis Hotel. That, too, seemed a natural development. I felt proud to be sitting there with her, though I knew that strangers would take her for my daughter. Tell me more about yourself, I said.
I went to a boarding school I didn't like, called after St. Catherine, but without her charity. I was bad at maths and French and geography. I didn't like a girl called Angela Tate, and I didn't like the breakfasts. I missed my brothers. What about you? What was your wife like?
Fond of clothes. Fine tweeds. A certain shade of scarlet. Scarves of every possible variation. She hated trailing after me abroad.
I didn't add that Charlotte had been unfaithful with anyone she had a fancy for. I didn't even want to think about that. The waiter brought Dorothea, veal escalope, and steak au poivre for me. It was very like being in a dream. Before I'd met this girl, I'd felt wound up, like a spring, seeing vividly in my mind's eye the old grey woman who'd been my mother-in-law. She and I had shared the truth about her daughter, and it was that I'd honoured by making the journey to her funeral.
This is really very nice, you know.
What did you say when you telephoned your parents' house? That you'd been picked up by a middle-aged journalist who'd come to Bath to attend a funeral?
I said I'd met someone interesting.
Oh, I wouldn't say interesting.
Do you really like Jane Austen?
Yes.
I love Mr. Woodhouse.
And I, Mrs. Elton.
If a woman is partial to a man and does not endeavour to conceal it, he must find it out. Don't you love the expression of a woman being partial to a man?
I walked with her to a parked car, a white Mini that had collected a traffic warden's ticket. Formally, we shook hands, and all the way to London on the train, I thought of her. I sat in the bar, drinking one after another of those miniature bottles of whiskey that trains go in for, while her face was as lively in my imagination as it had been in reality. Again and again, her white, even teeth smiled at me. Her eyes were dazzling. Within a day or two, I was in Belfast, sending reports to a Washington newspaper and to a syndicate in Australia. As well, as always, I posted photostats of everything I wrote to Stoikov, who operates the news bureau in Prague. Stoikov used to pay me whenever he saw me, well, quite handsomely, in a sense, but it was never the money that mattered. It was simply that I saw no reason why the truth about Northern Ireland should not be told behind the Iron Curtain, as well as in Washington and Adelaide. I'd agreed to do a 2-month stint, no longer, because from experience I knew that Belfast becomes depressing. Immediately afterwards, I was to spend 3 days in Madrid, trying to discover if there was truth in the persistent rumours that the Pope was to visit Spain next year. Great Christ alive, Charlotte used to scream at me, to call this a marriage? In Belfast, the army was doing its best to hush up a rape case. I interviewed a man called Rory O'Boyle, whom I'd last seen drilling a gang of terrorists in the Syrian desert. My dear fellow, you can hardly call this rape, a Major Trubstall insisted. The girl was yelling her head off for it. But the girl had been doing no such thing. The girl was whey-faced, unable to stop crying. The girl was still in pain. She'd been rushed to hospital to have stitches. Listen, Major Trubstall said, pushing a great crimson face into mine. If a girl goes out drinking with four soldiers, do you think she isn't asking for something? The red hand of Ulster meant what it said, O'Boyle told me. The hand was waiting to grasp the hammer and the sickle. He didn't say it to his followers, and later he denied he'd said it at all. Rory O'Boyle is a sham, I wrote. And so it would appear is a man called Major Trubstall. Fantasy rules, I wrote, knowing it was the truth. All the time, in Northern Ireland, and for 3 days in Spain, her voice continued about Emma and Eleanor and Mr. Woodhouse and the Eltons. I kept imagining us together in an empty house that appeared to have become our home. Like smoke evaporating, my failed marriage wasn't there anymore. And my distant childhood, uneasy even in retrospect, slipped away also, as though touched by magic. Dorothea?
No, this is her mother.
Oh.
Please hold on, I'll fetch her.
I waited for so long, I began to fear that this was Mrs. Lysard's way of dealing with unwelcome suitors. I felt that perhaps the single word I'd spoken had been enough to convey an image of my unsuitableness and my presumption.
Yes?
Dorothea, it's me. Terrace, do you remember?
Of course I remember. Are you in Bath again, Terrace?
No, but at least I've returned from Northern Ireland. I'm in London. How are you, Dorothea?
I'm very well. Are you well?
Yes.
It's nice of you to ring, Terrace.
Do you think we might meet? It'd be nice to see you. Look, it doesn't matter.
Of course we must meet. Would Thursday do? I have to be in London then.
But we could have lunch again.
That would be lovely.
And so it was. We sat in the bow window of an Italian restaurant in Romilly Street. And when anyone glanced in, I felt inordinately proud. It was early September, a warm, clear day without a hint of autumn. Afterwards, we strolled through Leicester Square and along Piccadilly. We were still in Green Park at 6 o'clock.
I love you, Terrace.
I love you too.
I thought about you all the time.
Yes, I know. We walked into the Ritz and sat among the potted plants, drinking sweet martinis. It was then that Dorothea first told me about her family. Naturally enough, because I was going to have to meet them. I imagined Wisteria Lodge, quiet among its lawns and flowerbeds, its azaleas and magnolias, and the beech tree that dominated everything.
is a special girl, you know, Dorothy Ash.
Yes, I do know Mrs. Lysart.
We're awfully fond of her. We're a tightly bound family, well, you may have noticed. We're very much a family.
Oh, yes, indeed.
We've heard so much. How very nice to meet you.
Her mother smiled, a slanting smile at me, head a little to one side. She laid down an embroidery on a round cane frame. She held a hand out.
My sons.
Ah.
The taller one is Adam.
The smaller, Jonathan. How do you do?
How do you do?
Do you think they look like twins?
Well,
Mr. Terrence.
Oh, thanks very much.
My dear fellow.
Oh, how do you do, Dr. Lysart?
How do you do? A pleasure, a real pleasure, Mr. Terrace.
Terrace is his Christian name.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Besides, you mustn't call him Mr. After all, he is to be your son-in-law.
Terrace?
Yes, it is an odd name.
Dr. Lysart is an amateur archaeologist. Dorothea had shown me a photograph of him. Tall, very thin, dusty in a crumpled linen suit, holding between finger and thumb a piece of glazed terracotta. All that suited him better, it seemed to me, than the role of medical doctor in a Wiltshire village. I'm sure he's perfectly efficient with a stethoscope, but somehow he did not give that impression. He's handsome, in his gaunt way, as all the Lysart family are. Adam and Jonathan with their mother's dashing looks. Dorothea, outbidding all of them in terms of beauty. The boys were both at Cambridge. They had the pale blue eyes their parents shared, which Dorothea had too, and their father's languid tallness. But otherwise, they were right to say that they didn't look much like twins. In the large, flowery drawing room, they stood on either side of Dorothea's chair while all of us drank sherry. I was aware that, however protective their similar stance might be, they were not protecting Dorothea from me. I was not an interloper. They did not resent me. Their youth made me feel even older than I was, more knocked about, less suitable than ever for marriage with their sister. Yet that was a fact that registered on none of the Lysart's faces. I couldn't understand why the family so easily accepted me. It didn't quite make sense.
It's Chateau Giscourt 66, Terrace. Do you like it?
Delicious.
Do you know Chateau Coutet? We have some 73.
I drink whatever I'm given. I'm totally ignorant of wine.
This family's ignorant also. Adam and I do our best.
Yeah, yeah.
Jonathan.
Some more wine, Jonathan.
Will you have any more?
Father?
I must say, I enjoy cooking. That's a terrible thing to say, but I do. It's quite as good as this.
I first became interested in 1945. 20 feet of rubble, another 12 of digging, and there it was. Perfection. Oh, do have some port.
Oh, thank you.
You're not an archaeologist yourself, Mr. Terrace.
No, not at all.
Nor was I until that day. Not that I am now. Purely fun, you know. All just for fun. So different from attending the unwell.
Indeed.
One can become tired of that.
I'm sure.
Dorothea wants to marry you.
Well, we both,
yes,
actually.
Yes, so she's told me.
I'm closer to your own age than to hers.
Oh, yes, you probably are. I'm glad you like her.
I love her.
Of course.
And I hope...
My dear fellow, we're delighted.
I'm a correspondent, Dr. Lysart, as Dorothea, I think, has told you. I move about a bit, but for the next year, I think I'll be in Scandinavia.
Of course, we've always known that Dorothea would one day wish to marry.
Well, I know I'm not what you must have had in mind when you thought of Dorothea's husband. I assure you, I am aware of that.
Oh, it's just that she's more vulnerable than she seems to be. I just want to say that. She's really a very vulnerable girl.
Oh, I promise you, I'll always look after her.
Oh, my dear fellow.
I spent that night at Wisteria Lodge and noticed, when we returned to the drawing-room and again at breakfast-time, how right Mrs. Lysaght had been when she'd said that the family was a tightly bound one. Conversation drifted from one Lysaght to the next in a way that was almost artificial, as though the domestic scenes I witnessed belonged in the theatre. I formed the impression that the Lysaarts invariably knew what was coming next, as though their lines had been learned. My presence was accommodated through a telepathy that was certainly as impressive. Another piece of practiced theatre.
Yes, we're like that. We never seem to quarrel. Shall we play croquet now?
Oh, you'll have to teach me.
We don't even quarrel when we play croquet, which is rather something, you know.
Oh, hard luck.
Yeah.
Ah, she always wins, Terrace.
She entices every unsuspecting visitor onto the lawn, and then she wins.
Come and have some lemonade. It's a perfect training for life, the game of croquet.
Then Dorothea is perfectly trained.
Don't you think she is, Terrace? Had you realised you're marrying a perfectly trained wife?
Oh, I think I had.
Cunning pays in croquet. Generosity must know its place.
Not that we're against generosity, Terrace. Not that we're on the side of cunning.
Oh, what a family poor Terrace is marrying into.
Terrace is a natural croquet player.
Oh.
He will one day put you all to shame.
Ah, but not just yet.
Occasion when old Major Winthrop said someone else had cheated.
Oh, yes.
We were no more than eight adults.
It was father, he said, who cheated.
And he was right.
Father has a way of taking two tiny shots to slither a ball through a hoop. The second one is well disguised.
Oh, lovely, Dorothea.
You must aim at hers, Terrace. No, not at Jonathan's. Dorothea's is easier.
Good.
Now, you bring your ball back and place it by hers, as you've seen us doing.
Oh, it seemed unfair.
Oh, not unfair at all. Now hit hers into kingdom come.
You shouldn't tell him. You shouldn't, Jonathan. Oh!
Oh, lovely, Terrace.
Mother's quite right.
But Dorothea won't lose, you know. Dorothea can't bear to lose.
We sat at a round, white-painted table and drank some more of Mrs. Lysaght's lemonade. After lunch, and after further reminiscences of great croquet occasions of the past, Dorothy and I went for a walk. We had to say goodbye to one another because I was to leave Wisteria Lodge that evening, and when eventually I returned, it would be almost the day we'd set for our wedding. We walked very slowly through the village and out into the country.
Well, what do you think of them?
They're charming. You're a charming family.
All you've ever told me about yourself is that you're an only child.
Ah, well, my parents are dead now. We lived in a seaside town, not at all like your family. We'd once been well-to-do, but no longer were. My father worked in the offices his grandfather had owned, trawling business.
Very sad.
Mm. We actually lived in a kind of disgrace. My parents tried to cover it over, but that only made it worse.
I'm sorry.
Doesn't matter now.
Will you one day show me where you played as a child? And where you went to school? Are there graves in the graveyard? Family graves?
It's full of them.
We left the road and passed along a track by the side of a cornfield. We sat with our backs against an ivy-covered tree stump by a stream.
We shall teach the Scandinavians the rules of croquet. Oh, Terrace, I'm so glad we met that day in the pump room.
I made love to Dorothea, there by the stream. The first and only time. Afterwards, we washed and lay in the sun. It was then that Dorothea told me the story of Agnes Kemp.
She was 12 at the time, staying with us while her parents were abroad. She fell from the beech tree. Her neck was broken. I had always wanted to climb that tree. I had been told I never must. I dare you, she said. I dare you, Dorothea. I was frightened. But when no one was looking, we climbed it together, racing one another to the top.
She spoke of the funeral of Agnes Kemp. How the child's parents had not been present because it had been impossible to contact them in time.
We don't hear much of them now. A card at Christmas.
What was she like?
Oh, she was really awfully spoilt. The kind of person who makes you furious.
I suppose it was that last remark that started everything off. That, and the feeling that Wisteria Lodge was a kind of theatre. The remark passed unnoticed at the time, for even as she made it, Dorothea turned to me and smiled and kissed me.
It's all forgotten now, but of course I had to tell you.
It was certainly forgotten, for when we arrived in the garden, the white table we'd sat around after our croquet game had been moved out to the glare of the sun. It was beneath the beech tree. Tea, with scones and sandwiches and cake, was spread all over it.
Your father's been called out again. Poor Mrs. Bulstrode.
I've been reading about Castlereagh. Most remarkable man. Well, I can't remember a thing about him.
Those sandwiches are cress, and the others are anchovy.
Tea is what I want.
I'm sorry it wasn't any cucumber. I didn't like the man.
I felt a dryness in my mouth that was not dispelled when I drank. I found it hard to eat, and even to smile in unison with the smiling faces around me. I kept seeing the spoilt child on the grass beneath the tree, and Dr. Lysard bending over her, saying that she was dead, as no doubt he must have. I kept thinking that the beech tree should have been cut down years ago, no matter how beautiful it was. In the darkness, I'm assaulted by my thoughts. It's 4 days now before our wedding. I've returned to Wisteria Lodge, but I do not think of Dorothea in her wedding dress, or of the wedding dress, or of the wedding guests on the lawn, or the wonder of being with her, the two of us alone. You're mad, Charlotte shouted at me more than once. You're actually mad. Her voice, in its endless repetition, is always a reminder of my parents' faces, that worry in their eyes. All I'd wanted to know was the truth about the downfall of ourselves. Why did the offices and warehouses still bear our name? What had my grandfather done? Best just left, my mother said. Best not bothered with. But in the end they told me, because naturally I persisted. At 8 and at 12 and at 18, naturally I persisted. My grandfather had been a criminal and that was that. A drunkard and an embezzler, a gambler who'd run through a fortune in a handful of years. I'd guessed, of course, by the time they told me. I don't know why they'd been so reluctant, or why they'd displayed such concern when I persisted about Miss McNamara. Why did she weep when she walked the promenade? I had to guess again, because for all my childhood, Miss McNamara's tears possessed me. She wept for the music teacher, who was married and had a family, and I did not forgive my parents for wishing to keep that covered up. Passionately, I did not forgive them. Although my mother begged me to, saying that I made myself unhappy. You sound so noble, Charlotte used to snap at me. Yet what's so particularly marvellous about exposing a brothel keeper for peddling drugs, or a grimy pederast and a government minister? Charlotte's mother knew all about her. A tricky kind of customer, she once actually said, and tricky was the word. Tricky, no doubt, with bank tellers and men met idly in bars, tricky in beds, all over the place. When I was so often away, having to be away, in the darkness. I cross the bedroom to the window. I can see the beech tree, lit by moonlight now. I hear the voices that have haunted me ever since Dorothea told me the story of Agnes Kemp.
Wait for me! Then I dare you to, Agnes!
Yes! Hurry, Dorothea, quickly now!
Oh, she'll find us. She'll always find us. Why are you running away? Because we don't like you.
Yes.
You shouldn't say that. You're frightened to climb the beech tree. You don't like me knowing. You're ashamed, Dorothea.
Of course I'm not ashamed.
Then climb it. You can climb it yourself. You're a horrid person. You aren't even pretty.
No.
You're stupid and spoiled and greedy. You always have two helpers.
Yes.
There's something the matter with your eyes.
There isn't, Dorothea Lysart. You're jealous, that's all.
Yeah.
You're jealous and frightened and ashamed.
They're pig's eyes.
Yes.
You're half a pig.
Piggy.
A pig, probably.
Piggy.
You're just afraid of a tree, Dorothea.
They climb it, both at the same time, from opposite sides. There's a forked branch near the top, a sprawling, knobbly crutch, easily distinguishable from the ground. They race to that. The boys watch, expecting any moment that an adult voice will cry out in horror from the house. But no voice does. The blue dress of Agnes Kemp and the white one of Dorothea disappear into a mass of leaves. The boys stand further back. The dresses reappear. Agnes Kemp is in front, but their sister has chosen a different route, shorter, it seems. The boys long for their sister to win, because if she does, Agnes Kemp will at least be quiet for a day or two. They don't call out, although they want to. They want to advise Dorothea that in a moment or two she will have overtaken her challenger. They don't, because their voices might attract attention from the house. From where they stand, they can hear the grandfather clock in the hall striking 10 o'clock. Most of the windows are open.
I hate you. I hate you, Agnes Kemp. I hate your pig eyes and your ugly voice. And I hate your awful smile. Right shoes for climbing. Typical to know we would climb the tree today.
The blue dress reaches the fork and then advances along one of its prongs, further than is necessary. Dorothea is a yard behind, angry and defeated, angry that Agnes Kemp should have climbed further than was necessary. She waits, crouched at the knobbly juncture. She waits for Agnes's return. The boys don't understand that. They stare, wondering why their sister doesn't climb down again so that they can all three run away from Agnes Kemp, for it is running away from her that has been in their mind since breakfast time. They watch while Agnes Kemp reaches a point at which she can pose triumphantly. They watch while she creeps backwards along the branch. Their sister's hand reaches out. Terrified. The boys look straight at one another. Adam says something, rasp of words in his throat that does not make sense. Jonathan cries. The boys stand, not moving. Their sister's descent is swift and agile. She slips down the wide trunk, dropping the last few feet and hurrying to the sprawled figure.
Did anyone dream?
I've been skipping French classes again. For a year, or even longer, apparently. I've been keeping so low a profile that Monsieur Bertin didn't even know I existed. And then some examination or other loomed.
Adam often has that dream, Terry. Yes. It tells us a lot about him.
I was in Istanbul. Or at least it seemed like Istanbul. A man was selling me stolen goods. A picture of a goat by Marc Chagall.
Very likely.
I had only a whisper of a thing. A bit out of Dorothea's berth.
I dreamed that Terry's wife was picking scallions in the garden. You're wrong to think there's been a divorce, she said. And then she was someone else, a woman on the train the other day.
Did you dream, Terrace?
No, I didn't.
Actually, you mean you don't remember, darling. You have to dream if you sleep at all.
What's the criterion for As You Like It? 10 letters beginning probably with T.
Touchstone.
Right. And 5 letters beginning with N, ending with H. Lord of Eden End.
Lord of Eden End. Oh, would that be Lord North, perhaps?
Of course. Oh. Yes. And poison, precious to Milton and to Mrs. Webb, is bane, isn't it?
Father's showing off. Yes, it is.
Monsieur Bertin was little more than a dwarf, Terrace, but very fat.
Lysette Minor is the worst I have ever had the ill fortune to teach.
Yes, but he didn't exactly think the world of Jonathan either.
A charming little man, I always thought.
Oh, you didn't know him.
Oh, I can visit you in Copenhagen, you know. In February, it would be.
Oh, do, please do, Jonathan.
It could not be true. In the sunny breakfast room, while the marmalade was passed and the flowered china had all the prettiness of a cottage garden, the horror was nonsensical. Mrs. Lysart's elegance, her perfect features and her burnished hair would surely not be as they were. No wrinkles creased her face. The doctor's eyes were honestly untroubled, forget-me-not blue. Dorothea's laughter would surely be less joyful, her hands less beautiful. The fingers clawing at the blue dress would surely have acquired some sign, a joint, arthritic, a single bitten nail. The faces of the boys could not have shed all traces of the awful ugliness. Dear, it isn't our affair why Miss McNamara is troubled, my mother agitatedly protests. Senseless, Charlotte shouts again. Everything you say is senseless. On Tuesday afternoon, 3 days away, we would marry, and the car would take us to the station at Bath, after the champagne on the lawn, or in the drawing room and dining room, if it rained. Our flight to Paris was at 7:05. We would have dinner in the Chez Les Anges. Our room was booked in the Caire Copatel. I would be proud on the streets of Paris, as I had been in Bath and London. We would visit Versailles and Rouen and the Jeu de Paume because Dorothea had never been there. I may, for a moment, have closed my eyes at the breakfast table. So lost was I in speculation and imaginings.
I think we might go for a walk.
Well, yes, I have a surgery.
Yes, and I have Castlereagh still to ponder about.
For a moment, in the sunny room, the brothers stood again by Dorothea. Perhaps an accidental conjunction or telepathy had come into play. Perhaps they somehow guessed the contents of my mind. There was defiance in their stance. Also, I thought, a reason for it now.
When I was little, I used to ride here on my ponies. On Jess first, later on Adonis.
We walked, as we had on the day we'd made love, through a spinney, along the track by the cornfield. Poppies, not in bloom before, were everywhere now. Cow parsley whitened the hedges.
The first thing I remember is that bits of grass got into my pram.
I told myself I should mention Agnes Kemp, but I did not do so. And when we reached the stream, I did not embrace the girl who was to be my bride in a few days' time. We sat with our backs against the tree trunk, watching the ripple of the water.
I was lifted up, and there was a great tutting, I can tell you, while the grass cuttings were removed.
Years went by before I can remember anything else.
Murder was not like stealing a pencil sharpener at school or spilling something. Agnes Kemp had been detested. A secret had afterwards become a way of life. A few words had perhaps been spoken within the family, Dr. Lysaart's giving the cause of death as a broken neck, perhaps being the only announcement as to how the future should be. The faces on the lawn returned to me, and Dorothea's face as she looked down at the still body. Had she afterwards ridden her pony, Jess, or Adonis, by the cornfield and the poppies? I dreamed of Agnes was what she didn't say at breakfast time anymore, because among them they'd exorcised the ghost.
I remember next a bird's nest, being lifted up to see the speckled eggs. The thrushes, I suppose. Oh, darling, I can't wait to be married.
Great Christ alive, Charlotte used to scream at me. Do you call this a marriage? She would not forgive my simple affliction. The awful nagging of the truth. She would not see that I was haunted by it and possessed. I was not an interloper. They did not resent me. I couldn't understand why the family so easily...
It's Chateau 66 Terrace. Do you like
it? I first became interested in 1945. 20 feet of rubble, another 12 of digging, and there it was.
Oh, perfect. Darling, I can't wait to be married.
You're mad, Charlotte said. You are actually mad. But I wasn't mad. I bore my affliction, and I even earned my livelihood from it. Until in the end, there was Dorothea's perfect oval face. Her eyes of a washed-out blue. Her easy smile. It was too much that she was no different from everyone else. Of course, I could not bear it then.
I hate you, Agnes Kemp. I hate your pig eyes and your ugly voice.
Though once I was not. There's a window in the small grey room where I have to be alone. But I've never looked out of it. I prefer, when I open my eyes, to gaze at the cinder walls while quietly I go on talking to myself. Alone, Miss McNamara walks. The winter waves tumble about. Sea spray. My mother, first of all, lies. Sea spray on her cheeks, dear. How can my father, morning after morning, leave our gaunt house in order to perform his ignominious work? Pretending it is work like any other. How can he hope that I will not scratch away the lies they tell? My father is caught like a creature in a trap, forever paying back the debts my grandfather has incurred. It isn't nice, Miss McNamara and a music teacher. It isn't nice, the truth in Northern Ireland. None of it is nice. Americans give arms away. Russians promise tanks. I stand again in the cathedral at Vaisley. Pleased that Pope Boniface exposed their pretense about Mary Magdalene. Charlotte passes me a drink, smiling with her satisfaction. Our fingers touch. I know how she has spent that afternoon. Poor Dorothea, Mrs. Lysaart comforts. and the boys are angry because Dorothea has always needed looking after, ever since the day of the accident, the wretched death of a nuisance. I know I am right, as that Pope knew also. They hold me and they buckle the thing on me, but still, I know I am right. Flowers are arranged in vases. Croquet played beneath the beech tree. Rory O'Boyle adopts a hero's voice to proclaim his pretense of a cause. Major Tubsall's smile is loaded with hypocrisy. A blue dress flutters and is still telling me again that I am right.